Show.
Yo 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 yam yam tam magna shraddhaya chito michyati tasya tasya chala chala shraddha tameva vidhanyam.
Hi friends, it's me, Duncan, and you're listening to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. I'm not sure what part of the time-space continuum you happen to be floating down on the meaty inner tube that you call your body, but from this part of the river, I just want to say hello to you. Trapped in time like a fly stuck in the swirling vortex of a toilet, but not being sucked down into the city sewers, being sucked in the direction of a thing that someone I am very fond of termed the strange attractor at the end of time. Today, maybe you're aware, maybe you're not, if you happen to be listening to this today, November 16th, today is the birthday of one of the greatest philosophers and psychonauts and mind blowers that ever walked across this strange extrusion of matter that we call planet Earth. I'm trying to talk like Terrence McKenna, who truly is the ultimate mind melter. In my life, I've never encountered anybody so adept at flying into the realms of the psychedelic, at inhaling dimethyltryptamine or eating what he called heroic doses of mushrooms and allowing himself to experience that incredible subjective apocalypse that comes from a tremendous dose of psychedelics, and then somehow being able to bring that experience back here into consensus reality and to articulate it in a way that makes it somewhat understandable. Terrence McKenna is so good at describing the psychedelic mind state that he is his own form of psychedelic. And I can remember the first time reading him feeling as though I were having some kind of flashback. He's the best. So in honor of this great man's birthday, I'm just going to play a clip that I found on YouTube, which is a talk he was giving in Maui.
We are all in the grip of a transformative attractor, an attractor which over very long periods of time produced stable biosystems, oceans and jungles full of life. Over a very short period of time, thousands of years, has produced human civilizations, art movements, dynastic families, languages, migrations, and since 1945, pick a number, we have been in a kind of hyper-accelerated phase where culture has not changed that much. What has changed is technology. Technology is now evolving at such a rate, I was saying to someone today, we don't even have software that pushes our hardware to its limits. No one now knows the limits of our hardware. It's a software writer's challenge to even find the edge of what these machines can do. But it isn't, and I want to stress this, it isn't something that we are doing. It isn't something that is being driven by a human, political, or social agenda. It is that we, like the dolphins, like the groundhogs, like the giant squid and the honeybee, we are embedded in the matrix of physics, of the actual underlying facts of this local structure of this universe. And what has happened is, we are on a collision course with something we can't even describe or imagine. We have a vocabulary of things you can run into. You can run into other planets, bad weather, large asteroids, mercenary or missionary extraterrestrials, so forth and so on. What we are about to run into is none of the above. Something much more peculiar. Let's call it interdimensional white hole. Let's call it a mirror traveling backward at the speed of light through time. let's call it, you know, last week's laundry list, whatever you call it, the point is it's going to blow your mind. And at this point in time, the only anticipation is in recourse to these shamanic experiences of boundary dissolution that we are calling psychedelic and stigmatizing furiously as a kind of social heresy. It is a kind of social heresy, because real heresies are always about a truck with truths that don't want to be articulated, that are literally unthinkable or unsayable. And this is the kind of situation in which we find ourselves, suspended halfway between the animal and the transcendental. At the end of the 20th century, with all the contradictions of Western civilization seething in our laps, it now turns out that there is a kind of redemption that hovers in an intermediate space between secular and religious. It isn't the return of the goddess. It isn't divine retribution. It's the laws of physics seem to be about to rescue us from ourselves. And in fact, our entire career through time has been at the whim of an imploding set of physical laws. That's worth a drink.
That is our Lord and Savior, Terrence McKenna, at a talk he gave in Maui. You can find that in the comments section of this episode, or go on YouTube and Google search Ananda Das, and you will find that he has uploaded this entire 2.5-hour lecture to YouTube. If you've missed Terrence McKenna and you're wondering where to start off, I would recommend The Archaic Revival, though so many of his books are incredible. And also, if you don't feel like buying a book or reading a book, there are probably hundreds of hours of him giving brilliant lectures all over the world, which are now available all over the internet. And when you listen to him or when you read him, keep in mind that this guy came way before virtual reality goggles, that when he was talking about the processors inside computers, they weren't even close to as powerful as computers currently are. And yet, just with his understanding of the way things seem to be moving, he was able to extrapolate the strangeness that we are all currently collectively experiencing. He's the master of talking about this stuff, and I hope you will check him out. And there is no better day to release this episode than Terrence McKenna's birthday, because today's guest has been to Peru, has studied under medicine men in Peru, and is such a mind-blowing fellow that this morning I woke up thinking about where my third eye was in my head and wondering if I could talk to trees. All of this inspired by the conversation that you're about to hear. We're going to jump right into it, but first, some very quick business.
No, no, no.
This episode of the DTFH is brought to you by Casper.com. Friends, did you know that there was a time when there was far more oxygen on planet Earth? And because of this extra oxygen, massive forms of life were able to exist. Huge, monstrous flies would land on top of the enormous turds blasted out of the buttholes of dinosaurs. And these flies were deadly, deadly things. In those days, had there been humans, they would know better than to sleep on a dinosaur turd, because to sleep on the dinosaur turd would mean that you would be carried away by one of these monstrous flies to some kind of disgusting mucusy fly hole where you would be slowly disassembled, dissolved, and eventually liquefied and then slurped up by this terrible prehistoric insect. In the same way you don't want to sleep on a dinosaur turd, you don't want to sleep on a shitty mattress. Because in the same way dinosaur turds attract giant flies, shitty human mattresses attract giant demons. Yes, you heard me. A horrible mattress is like a beacon to demons. There where you lay in your most vulnerable state, your astral body traveling through all the various realms from the lowest hells to the highest heavens, your body lays in a state of absolute and complete vulnerability. And if you are on a bad mattress, may God help you. When legions of demons go flying into your body, climbing into the dark recesses of your subconscious mind and sending shitty thoughts with such great rapidity through your consciousness that you will begin to confuse the mutterings of demons with your very own thought process, all thanks to that monster mattress that you decided to lay on top of. A mattress that you probably spent an entire day shopping for at some dark, smarmy, musky, stinky mattress shop. Well, thanks to the glorious saviors over at Casper.com, you no longer have to risk being possessed by demons or being manipulated by a monstrous mattress salesman in some dark mattress maze. All you've got to do is go to Casper.com/family hour and you will get $50 towards any mattress purchase. The Casper is an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. It combines springy latex and supportive memory foams and an award-winning sleep surface with just the right sink and just the right bounce. That means it's good for humping. Time magazine named it one of the best inventions of 2015. In fact, it's now the most awarded mattress of the decade. And I'm going to give it an award right now. Casper, I hereby give you the Universal Mattress Award, also known as the Gentleman's Pin. Free shipping and returns to US and Canada. You can try Casper for 100 nights risk-free in your own home. If you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. It's made in America. And most importantly, I sleep on one of these babies, and you should too. Give it a shot. If you don't like it, you could send the mattress back. And trying out one of these glorious mattresses is a great way to tell the sweeties over at Casper.com that it was worth it to sponsor this podcast. There's lots of great ways for you, if you feel so inclined, to support the DTFH. One of these ways is to go visit our shop. We got a lot of great t-shirts and posters. Another way is to go check out our Amazon link in the comments section of any of these episodes. You know, the link was screwed up. I forgot to put in some code. And so for the last few episodes, people have been asking where the link is, and I didn't know what they were talking about. So my simultaneous apologies and thanks to you for even attempting to use that link to buy whatever we were talking about or whatever you feel like buying on Amazon. I don't know if you've noticed this or not, but lots of people are going Looney Tunes right now, and it might not be the best time to put that precious, fragile meat body of yours into that cataclysmic river of metal and steel that we call human traffic, just so that you can pick up some Windex, Toblerone, and deodorant. All of these things can easily be found by clicking on the Amazon link located in the comments section of this particular episode. You will see a thing that says Duncan Recommends, and there all you got to do is click, and you can have that Windex, toilet paper, whatever else you need from Amazon. I've thrown some things in there that I like. The new Razer, Jesus Christ, the new Razer laptop gaming computer, which I don't own one, but it's something that I dream of buying one day, but I don't want to do it because I recently got addicted to World of Warcraft, which is why I also placed on there a link to a what's called an MMO mouse, which has got all these buttons on the side so that you can, as you steer your character through a hypnotic, seemingly CIA-created mind control mechanism like World of Warcraft, you can more easily attack the fantasy creatures that you are confronting. Anywho, all of this stuff is available at Amazon.com, and if you go through that link or use Duncan Recommends, and they will give us a very small percentage of anything that you buy, and it costs you nothing. It's a great way for you to support this podcast. And another great way for you to support the podcast is just to subscribe to us on iTunes, or if you really want to go deep, why not sign up for the forum located at DuncanTrussell.com? Get in on this conversation that has been happening for several years. I would love to see you there. Today's guest has studied plant medicines in Peru with two South American medicine men. He is a mind-blowing human. You can find him by going to HamiltonSouther.com. If you can't remember that, just go to the comment section of this website. The link to connect to Hamilton will be there. All right, everybody, please unzip your pineal pants and pull out your pineal glands to welcome our amazing guest, the great Maestro Hamilton Souther. Hamilton, welcome.
Hi.
Thank you for coming over.
Thank you for having me.
This is the very first time I've had a shaman on my podcast, I think. You're a shaman.
Back in the day, I was given the title of shaman, yeah.
But absolutely. You don't consider yourself a shaman?
I'm not sure what a shaman is anymore. The modern world has twisted my mind in terms of archetypes and understandings who and what something is.
Well, it's a weird title, isn't it? I mean, it's one of the most... it seems like there's really, with other titles, priest, cleric, there's generally like a well-known, organized religion behind so many of these mystical titles. But When it comes to shamanism, it's in, you know, we don't know. It's hard to understand how one becomes that person. How does that happen? How do you get to be a shaman?
I think it's ultimately an ancestral question. It's a question of cultures and mythology and anthropology, and you ultimately have a calling. The calling comes forth. It's traditionally expressed that way as a calling. And then if you're lucky enough to be in a culture or society that has shamans who can train you, if you've had a calling, then you can hopefully find someone who will train you.
Now, this calling, I've heard about it, it's painful.
Can be, yeah.
Nightmarish.
Can be.
You start feeling like you're going crazy.
Can be.
Which is interesting because that's some of the symptoms of schizophrenia, some of the symptoms of losing your mind are the symptoms of being called to become a shaman.
In modern terms, I would definitely say so. In anthropological terms, typically the extraordinary is what's necessary, and then that gets labeled in many different ways. But early on in my training, I had a really wonderful opportunity to talk to a psychiatrist and a psychologist, and I asked them both how they would describe the nature of the experiences I was having. And they said that while in their understanding that there's similarities, the difference is around functioning and around high functioning. And the idea of a shaman is that somehow the shaman goes through a training to align all of these pieces that allow the extraordinary to not only to not be broken, but also to perform something actually extraordinary for their tribe or for their community.
In the last podcast I did with Daniele Bolelli, he quoted, I don't remember who, but the quote is, the mystic and the madman swim in the same, or are in the same waters, but one drowns and one swims. So this training that you're talking about seems to be a way of processing some kind of extra data that some people seem to be taking in as opposed to other people, like the filter of the shaman, of the mystic. The thing is, dealing with emails is problematic for a lot of us. It's very stressful.
Yes.
Phone calls to our parents, to our friends, returning phone calls. So complex.
Yes.
If you add to that some kind of legion of extra-dimensional entities, gods, various embodiments of the divine intelligence, then your life becomes so extremely complicated at that point, or seems like it would, that the idea of being able to balance a connection to whatever that is, some kind of as of yet unquantified biome or some internal part of the human psyche, seems like it would become cumbersome. It would make it very difficult to function in the modern world.
Yeah, I think functioning in the modern world's hard, period. And with extraordinary experiences or extrasensory perception, sure, it can make it difficult. But I go back to the idea of really what the shaman is doing. And the shaman is part of a tribal society, and tribal societies live very close to the land. They're not dealing with email typically. They're right. dealing with daily life experiences without this great abstraction of modern society. And so it's a much more primitive society, a much more simpler society. And they don't deal with the same kind of difficulties and complexities that you would see a modern person live with.
But you do. I was going through your website what you represent, of course, is like we're seeing this incredible renaissance that seems to be somehow directly associated with ayahuasca. And everyone's aware of it. Everyone knows someone who's taken ayahuasca by now. And everyone has heard from people who've taken ayahuasca. And what they say is you need to drink ayahuasca over and over again. Take ayahuasca. It's healing. You know, people are saying this is the healing energy of nature. And do they really have
the credibility to say that?
Well, I mean, I think if you've had a moving experience, then yeah, I think that gives you credibility. Like if you're someone who has like had a life changing experience, then that's going to put you into a kind of missionary mindset, whether you're, it's going to, maybe you won't be considering perhaps what you are considering when you think about the advice for someone to take ayahuasca. You're not thinking of the countless sessions you've been involved with, the varying psychological, spiritual problems that can emerge from this intense experience. Someone who's had their life transformed just wants to spread that to other people. But what's curious about ayahuasca to me is that sometimes it seems like whatever the embodiment of that thing is, it also wants to tell people about it. It's almost as though there's a kind of fervent, in a hurry kind of thing that comes from people when they've had the experience. Like they feel like this is an imperative for a lot of people. Maybe they have different motives for that, but I've never found it to be off-putting. It just kind of makes sense to me. Do you think it's irresponsible for people who've had these monumental experiences to tell other people to enjoy them or to experiment with ayahuasca?
No, I don't think in any way there's any sort of conflict. The question to me always came around experiential understanding. And in the shamanic arts, like the mystic arts, extreme amount of experience is typically considered necessary to have a wide enough understanding of all of the ceremonial experiences, all of the sort of psychedelia that can be involved in it as well. The visionary experiences, the purgative experiences, the cathartic experiences, the extraordinary or the sort of beyond body, even though it's very difficult to describe what that means, experiences. And so in my own life, I just came to think that, the people that spoke with the most clarity about it had thousands of experiences, thousands, literally, in the Amazon. The people that had the greatest respect had 3,000, 4,000 experiences of ayahuasca under their belt, and then other people listened to them. And it was very different because they expressed a depth of knowledge and a wisdom about the experience that wasn't a missionizing expression. It wasn't, go try this. It was, if you're ill in these very specific ways and in these very specific reasons and in these very specific forms, and literally ill, like of an illness, diseased or sick, then this would be the appropriate medicinal plant to use under those circumstances. And so in my training, I found it really interesting that I got presented kind of really like a field study in plant medicine, the way akin to when my father described going through Western medical school and residency. Akin, like my father went through Western medical school and residency and became a surgeon, and I found myself in the Amazon in my early 20s hanging out with these other guys that didn't have Western medicine, but they had medicine. They had real medicine, the same way you would describe medicine and Western medicine. They had medicine and forms of plants and all of these different uses of the plants, including this psychomagical use that Western medicine had discarded. But the tribal medicine is ancestral to Western medicine. And so the psychomagical was part of all medicine until Western medicine decided that that was not a necessary part to continue to pursue or explore. So in my case, I was in the Amazon in my early 20s with these, you know, elders and masters, learning from them, where they were describing a nature of ascension and experience over 40 years. Okay, now in the Western world, in the neo-shamanic sort of revolution that's taking place, it's 5 ceremonies, 10 ceremonies, 100 ceremonies, 150 ceremonies of experience is a lot for somebody. And the masters who taught me were in their 40s and 80s when I was learning with them, and they were teaching, and you know, at that time they had each amassed somewhere between 3,000 and 6,000 ceremonies.
Can you describe what a typical day for 20, 23, 24-year-old you was like in the jungle with a shaman?
Yeah, and sure.
What time did you wake up, and just take me through a day of training?
Okay, so a day of training. I thank you for prefacing training, because there's a lot of days in the Amazon, you know. But a day of training would look like we had finished a night of ceremony the night before, and so we had probably finished the ceremony at 3 or 4 a.m., and then the day would start somewhere between 6 and 6:30 a.m., so that you'd get about 2 hours of sleep, and you would be presented a very large Mapacho jungle cigar as a before breakfast snack that you would start with as a purification.
Okay.
And then you would go down to the river and bathe, and then come back and have breakfast. And then there would be hard labor typically. Typically, the jungle is an environment where you have to work all day long to survive between mending things, agriculture, fishing and hunting to be able to eat and survive. We were living off of the land except for a small amount of supplies that we would take in with us. And so we were living a subsistence agricultural lifestyle. So we would... after breakfast, kind of through evening time, go into the jungle and either work or collect plants or perform agricultural tasks or continue to the development of our homestead. And then after that, we would kind of have an evening relaxation where we would hang out. And there were always different kinds of medicinal plants and potions around, as well as tobacco, and this kind of always a dialogue and an understanding of spirit, this idea of spirit. Now, it's very hard to describe what spirit is, energy, things. It's very hard, but in the jungle, it's all the time. It's just there all the time, and the people think like that all the time, and they live within their mythology all the time. And so that's in your head all the time.
Yeah.
And the oral history is being recounted all the time, and how people describe their experiences are in that oral history, and it's in the mythology, and they don't differentiate in their normal language from dream state to waking state to hallucinatory states.
Wow.
They just speak. And it's just consciousness to them. And so, you know, in interacting with them and stuff, we would go through kind of a time where I would, kind of like an anthropologist, ask questions endlessly, to which they would get frustrated sometimes or tired. But I would just, you know, ask question, thousands of questions. And then...
What language were you speaking?
They speak Spanish with a dialect. It's I would say maybe 50% of the vocabulary is Spanish vocabulary with a kind of... you know, not exactly following Spanish grammar. It's close. It's really close. Like the root of it is Spanish, but then there's all of these different language vocabulary words coming into it.
Okay.
And then we'd go into a ceremony in the night, you know, so we'd have that evening time, and then we would go into another ceremony. And ceremony meant training, and it meant learning, and it never meant like tripping out or just having fun. It was never like that. It was always very serious. It was considered life or death.
Life or death.
It was considered life or death.
Like you could in some way damage yourself during these ceremonies.
Yeah, like you could be harmed to the point that you would not physically recover, and it was considered life or death. Like,
and that has happened.
Yes, I never witnessed it in the time that I was there personally in our group of people, but I witnessed it outside of our group of people, and I have had many friends that have died.
And we hear this story. I mean, it always makes the news that people in ayahuasca ceremonies have died. Like, you do hear about that now. And what kind of death would you expect? Like a heart attack? Is it what happened?
And it's really hard from a Westerner's perspective to understand, because a Westerner is going to look at it from like, what's the, you know, pharmacological components involved and what's really taking place. And they're going to try and get really analytical about it. But until you've really experienced the nature of the ayahuasca ceremony, you don't really know what it's like to be in a living mythology. You don't know what it's like to be in that living dream. And we don't understand psychosomatic states. And so when they meant life or death, they meant that you could go into a psychosomatic reaction from training that could literally kill you. And I'm not talking about ayahuasca. I'm talking about training in the Amazon, where we worked with hundreds of plants, many of them extremely toxic.
Right.
Not just ayahuasca ceremonies. Many, many other plants, many of them considered, you know, not even supposed to be ingested. And the shamans have this really interesting mindset that you prove your capacity as a shaman by ingesting lethally poisonous substances. And they say only the chant that they give to it and your own inner fortitude can help you survive that experience. And
it makes me think of the Pentecostal Christians who like handle serpents, and the idea is you will be able to take up serpents and you want poison won't work on you anymore. This is an archetypical concept that if you surrender to the universe in some way, you're going to be protected in the most extraordinary ways. So that's very interesting. And I think another interesting distinction between this tradition of taking psychedelics versus modern traditions of taking psychedelics is if you take psychedelics these days, and you don't do it just to party, you do it for a soul-searching night with friends, they will say, don't worry, we're going to take care of you. I mean, I know that like you're not going to die. You'll be fine. No matter what, you're going to be fine. Bad trips are the best trips. And we've got a suitcase with Thorazine in it in case things get really wild. We'll just knock you out. So the idea that you're entering into these experiences in the most, for me at least, the most alien environment, speaking a different language in your 20s,
yep,
being told, yeah, you might die tonight.
Yeah.
That does not, when they talk about set and setting, right, is like the two primary important factors in a good trip. You need to be in a good mindset and you need to be in a good place.
Yeah.
It's like being at the top of a roller coaster, and as it's going off, the guy's like, yeah, I don't know, but the tracks might not work this go around. How do you deal with that, man? How do you deal with when I'm, look, if I just take a small amount of mushrooms, I'm certain I'm dying. Like, how do you deal with it? How would you deal with that in your 20s? By the way, I don't know, maybe you're still in your 20s, but how would you deal with that?
I'm 38 now.
Okay. How would you deal with that in your 20s in a hut after having worked all day and somebody's like, yeah, you could die tonight? How do you mentally deal with that?
You don't. You don't mentally deal with it. You're scared and you show up. It's show up or you're out. It's really simple. It's you show up to every ceremony or you're out. Like the Western ayahuasca culture and the Western psychedelic culture and what I was trained in are two entirely different things. They are not even remotely compatible to each other. I was accepted as close as a blood relative into these two ancient lineages that go back at least 7 or 8 generations of these medicine practices. And they don't have the same attitudes or beliefs of set and setting, nor do they have the same attitudes and beliefs around the purposes of these experiences. The purpose in a true shaman in a tribal society is to be a being who is capable of going into an extraordinary state with enough clarity to be able to retrieve something valuable for the tribe. And if it is not valuable, then you are not shaman. And you are tossed out. You are completely ostracized from that community, and you're not able to do really anything. I mean, you're not even functional anymore. And so this idea that a Western psychedelic experience could be compared to this, it doesn't really work because they're two totally different systems. In this system, it was about becoming something and transforming to take on the wildest difficulties that the tribe could possibly face, you know, from any kind of disease, physical illnesses, psychosomatic or spiritual based illnesses that they believe in, you know. And so it was never about a question of finding yourself or having a good experience, like the way the shamans facilitate those experiences for other people. To become trained as shaman, it's another direction. It's a different path.
So this is like, yeah. So it seems like there's a well mapped landscape that these people have for these experiences.
Absolutely.
And that's another difference too. And you know, I think it feels like you feel like Western psychedelic culture is Do you feel like it's, have you created like a hierarchy here where you?
No, okay. Not at all. No, I just think it's it gets confusing when the word ayahuasca gets thrown around as the means in which to describe the practices.
Okay, I got you.
Yeah,
okay,
because the substance is the same and the training is totally different. The purpose is totally different. The reason is totally different.
I got you.
The background behind it's totally different. Yeah. So I just want everyone to understand that you know, having an ayahuasca experience facilitated for Westerners, which is what we created in the Amazon, it was a purpose for that, is really designed to, you know, to allow someone to have the experiences that they're coming for, not training experiences. Like, you want your Navy SEAL guys to protect you. You don't want to go become one.
Right.
You want your shamans to be able to handle every single ceremonial experience that could possibly happen. I mean, you do not want your facilitator passing out. You don't want your facilitator running away. You don't want them having a cataclysmic psychological failure in the ceremony where they're facilitating it for you.
Can you imagine? Like, your shaman starts freaking out, you're fucked.
You're totally in a really terrible position, like you do not want that to happen. And that there are stories about that everywhere. That has never happened in our work or in our
like center. You gotta sit with your shaman and like rub his back
and help him out. Yeah, like let me now become your helper and facilitator and healer here or whatever.
Well, this is, you know, I think one of the primary errors people do make when they're taking psychedelics with friends is that they end up taking the same amount of psychedelics with someone who's never taken them before, and then they start freaking out and they have to like hide that. So this is one thing that is very notable about what you're talking about, is that I think what we're looking at here is the difference in what happens when people repress. And I know that the sacrament of ayahuasca does not encapsulate this religion. It's a religion, right? You could say it's a religion.
I don't know.
A tradition.
I would say in the Amazon, there are traditions of the use of this as a medicine. And then in other parts of the world, there are actual formed religions around the use of it as a sacrament.
But I suppose what they all have in common is this is a lineage of people who have been consuming psychoactive substances for, we don't even know how
thousands and thousands of years. I mean, there are pot shards, so little bits of ceramics with ayahuasca designs on them from 3,000 or 4,000 years ago. So,
whereas like here in the West,
yeah,
psychedelics for most of us are an illegal experience that if you've tried it, it's like a crazy thing to do. And we don't really have the maps for the experience like they do. And that's, to me, what's really interesting is that the Western concept of a psychedelic experience seems to be purely subjective. You're going into your own subconscious. You're seeing the processing of your brain, and it's going to be different for every single person.
Yeah.
So this concept of a shared psychedelic experience with aspects of it that repeat from person to person to person,
yeah,
are amazing to me, because that's a quantifiable thing. If they've really found a map for some kind of state of consciousness that somehow connects human beings within this realm that inflates while under the influence of these various psychedelics.
Yeah, absolutely.
Then that's quantifiable.
And I would say it is. I would say from my experiences that I've seen, the phenomena that are expressed are, they're incredible and they even seem miraculous at times, but they're literal and real and they're not even figurative. Like, when I first heard the descriptions of ayahuasca ceremonies and I went there, I said, come on, there's no way.
Right.
There's just no way. I've never had anything even remotely close to that. And I had, you know, experimented in other things in other ways and stuff. And so when I saw ayahuasca, after my first ayahuasca ceremony, I was like, there's no way that they underwrote those stories. They didn't overwrite those stories. They literally underwrote those stories. I couldn't even believe it, you know. And I think that's like where that huge impact is. And then hanging out with these guys, I mean, just to give an example of what you're talking about, like outside of ayahuasca ceremonies, deep in the jungle, like days away from a phone, Alberto and Julio used to say goodbye to each other, like the parting of two guys with a handshake around a couple of canoes, and say, call me if you need me. Literally, like, call me if you need me. And both of them had never used a telephone.
Yeah.
Okay, so now at first I thought, these guys are totally out there. They're playing on my mind. They're fooling with me. This can't be real.
Right.
And then all of a sudden I start to realize with them, they're very serious and they're being literal, you know, and then your world starts to change, you know, your mind.
Well,
starts
then how do you deal? Okay. So look, before we get into that, because yeah. I have a picture of Neem Karoli, Baba on my wall, which you noticed. And this is, of course, stories about him are very similar, which is there was no question about it. There was telepathy there. He just could do it. And it's real. So I'm curious, do you feel hesitant to talk about what you really think this is? Do you feel like you have to like translate this into a way, something that's palatable for people? Because I would suspect that you have like an idea of what this dimension is that people are entering into.
Sure.
What is it?
Okay. The terms are really hard to use because, no one knows what they mean. No one knows what dimension is. So you're going into a dimension, but what's that? I mean, what this is a expanded state of consciousness. Okay, and Sapien has a capacity to be able to align Sapien's consciousness, and when it does, extraordinary for people who are not aligned in that way, experiences happen. So you come with a Western mindset, and then you have this experience, and you go into this altered state and what people call another dimension or another world. But I would emphasize that that's what they call it. I'm not saying it is. I'm saying that's what they call it. What it is shared. And what it is literal. And what it is visionary. And what it is consciousness.
Why don't you want to call it another world?
Because it's this world. It's not another world. It's literally this world. And it's not another dimension. It's literally this dimension. And it's not another universe. It's literally this universe. And we're about expanding into the universe. And we're talking about expanding into the world. And we're talking about expanding into dimension and really learning what this is. So it's not just a mathematical concept that I'm going to sit in front of a whiteboard and be told this is a dimension. Instead, I'm going to have an experience where I'm going to come out of it and say, that was dimensional. That really was dimensional. Like, that made my math make sense. It made my science make sense. It made my history make sense. It made my own self make sense. It made the earth make sense. And, I just see that as something just so factual and so literal. It's not even of debate. And then there's all this other concept given to it. And the very first things that the shamans were teaching me was that there was no other. This was not an other experience. This was part of this, but you had to go into an extraordinary state to be able to achieve it or get into it or understand it. Mm.
Now the reports inevitably have within them contact with beings.
Yeah, for sure.
What are those beings?
Again, no one knows what those beings are, but what we know is that there's a if you go outside of the ayahuasca cultures and you go globally, there's at least a 15,000 to 50,000 year archaeological history of Homo sapiens experiencing beings, experiencing this extraordinary, experiencing these visions. And this is, again, what the shamans in the Amazon called spirit. And it's very simple to them. It's an energetic expression. Maybe very akin to like a Platonic concept of archetype.
You think that's what it is?
I think to them it is. I think that's what they're trying to describe, but they don't really understand outside of the mythology in a Western way how to describe it, right? But what is happening is that they understand spirit, for instance, like spirit of jaguar. It's not this jaguar named Kitty and this jaguar named Chloe.
Sure.
It's jaguar spirit, like original shape and original image of the jaguar. And then they call it a mama. They call it like the mother jaguar, like the first biggest mythological jaguar.
This is like Rupert Sheldrake's. What does he call that? Do you ever read any Rupert Sheldrake?
I haven't.
It's pretty interesting. So the idea is, and guys who are Sheldrake fans, prepared to send me an email about how I butchered this description because it's kind of.
I feel it.
But it's interesting because he talks about, I believe it's called the morphic field. And so the idea is like when a thing happens, it creates like a runnel in the time space continuum. So a thing happens, and then that thing happens, and then there's a tendency of that thing to happen because it happened once, and it might happen again. Now, if it happens again, it keeps happening, then suddenly you create this you know, platonic ideal, then suddenly, like, the jaguar, any jaguar you see in the wild, may you never see a jaguar in the wild, or I wouldn't want to, is more like a flower growing off of this infinite jaguar tree that's growing into time. It's interesting, you know, because this concept of entities, have you ever seen someone did a diagram where they took all these reports of DMT trips. You saw that?
Mm-hmm.
And the word that kept the words that came up the most were in bold, and entity just keeps coming up again and again and again. In the jungle, the entity has these very natural appearances, which is interesting to me, or from what I've heard. Please stop me if I'm wrong, but
yeah, I mean, I think you're just starting there. Though, I mean, that's a beginning of it. Those would be considered nature beings.
Nature beings.
Yeah. I mean, again, a way to classify and categorize a lot. I mean, in an ayahuasca ceremony, if we wanted to just think of them as something you're seeing,
yes,
and not try to describe what it is, but you're seeing it.
Yes.
And so you and I could both agree. Are you seeing that? And I'm like, yeah, I'm seeing that.
Yes.
You seeing that? Yeah, I'm seeing that.
Yes.
Okay. In that case, a shaman in an ayahuasca ceremony is going to be working with or calling or interacting with thousands to tens of thousands to millions to hundreds of millions in multiplicity of those things in an ayahuasca ceremony.
Calling on them.
Yes.
So you...
Knowing them, calling on them, and working with them. Fundamentally, a shaman is considered, like, of ayahuasca, a doctor of plant spirit medicine. And the spirit part is, like, kind of part of a trinity. It's... you know, plant spirit medicine. So you have the plant, you have the spirit, and then combined a medicine, which is going to do something positive for you.
Well, you have this concept of a shared, in a Western way of saying it, a shared hallucination.
Yeah.
So this
I like vision or hallucination. Both are good.
Vision's way better.
I like vision
way
better.
Yeah. But a shared. But let's just say okay, the idea of the shaman.
Yeah.
Goes into this space, brings something back to the tribe.
Correct.
And to bring it back to the tribe, he doesn't have to just be adept enough to find this information, whatever this data packet is, and bring it back into the world. He also has to be adept enough to understand the people he's communicating with. So he has to be a translator too, a kind of translator for this experience.
Yes.
So in the same way, it seems like the next step for this ayahuasca, I don't know what you would call it, this sudden explosion of ayahuasca into the world would be for people like you to figure out a way, not just to bring the data back for members of a tribe, but to bring the data back for members of the Western tribe and to in some way or another quantify these experiences. Because if there is a shared, if you can sit around a fire with people engaged in this ritual and say, hey, I'm seeing... What is something you have seen with a group?
I don't know. People always say that they see faces.
And they see the same face.
Yeah, I mean, there's many faces. They describe the faces, and then people agree that those are the faces that they were seeing.
So this is a quantifiable thing. And at that point, at this point now you have a way to open up and to revisit a much reviled and mainly debunked area of psychology, which is that many, many human beings have reported experiences like this. Many, many human beings have reported experiences with true clairvoyance. Insane. I have experienced this myself in my own way. But yet when you say that to like Richard Dawkins,
right?
He's like, fuck you. You are out of your mind. You are high on drugs. You are high. Your friends were high. Your experience is irrelevant, invalid, has nothing to do with anything that helps the world. Hippie. You know, that is, I don't even think I'm exaggerating.
No, I've heard many things like that in my life. I mean, that seems to be a common thread of thought and speech.
So why do you think this isn't being, I just wonder why here we have this, again, reports of these incredible experiences, shared experiences. How would you go about proving that human beings together can share in a vision, which implies... If you're saying that your friends could communicate with one another telepathically.
That's what they said.
And if this is true, which I think it is, but who the fuck am I? But I think it's true. If this is true, then it needs to be studied, quantified, and then we have to figure out a way to like teach this not just to people in this in the jungle, not just to people in certain areas of the world, but to the whole planet, right? Wouldn't you think?
I don't know. I don't know about teaching these things to everybody and what it's about and what it's not about. I think when I, you know, I did a lot of work in mind exploration and consciousness exploration, and what we're butting up against is ideologies. Right. We're just butting up against ideologies, and we've been butting up against ideologies for thousands of years, and many of the wars today on the planet are being fought over ideologies.
Yes.
And the expression that of the quote of the debunker is ideological, even though he's saying he's not ideological. And so I just don't see any reason to debate ideology. I just see ideology as is in a place of freedom of spirituality and religion. It's 100% someone's own thoughts and own ideas. And fundamentally, there's this huge problem right now that there is a consensus reality on the verb is. Like, oh, that is, oh, that is, oh, that is, oh, that's that thing, oh, that is, that is, that is, that is. And as that happens over and over and over again, people start to forget what something actually is. And so then we get this really like confined concept of existence reality, where existence reality is 100% what we know, but there's nothing outside of it now.
Right.
There's just nothing outside of it, but a whole universe 96.6 billion light years in diameter. So of my consensus personal reality, which is, and I've worked my whole life on expanding my reality, and I think of my reality could fit inside a bottle cap compared to 96.6 billion light years of universe that I'm part of right now during the podcast, utilizing it to speak. So being it, alive of it, part of it, feeling it, experiencing it real time, you know, as I'm speaking. So why do I think, why would I allow my mind to think that my reality is reality? Why would I think that reality, my concept of it, is describing a fact when I know philosophically within my own mind there are still paradoxes, there are still questions, there are still points of conflict, and there are still areas where I know that I'm just wrong?
I'll take a shot at answering the question. There is a story about the doctor who figured out that doctors should wash their hands. I can't remember his name. You could look it up on Google. But basically, there was a doctor who realized that if he washed his hands, prior to delivering a baby, then the infant mortality rate dropped because the baby wouldn't get sick. Because back then, they didn't know about germs. Had no idea. Didn't know about germs. So, I mean, which is crazy to think. So doctors would like handle dead bodies. They would like be in like some filthy hospital handling just blood. And, you know, actually, I just read that Ben Franklin or Thomas Jefferson, one of these, Ben Franklin, like there was a slave that told the slave owner about inoculation. And he was doing this and everyone was making fun of him. Like, what are you doing? In the same way, this doctor figured out you wash your hands and babies don't get sick. And other doctors responded, gentlemen do not wash their hands. That was the response. That's the ideology. So,
right, gentlemen.
Why combat ideologies? Why use the scientific method to create a repeatable experience when you're reporting some extraordinary experience or some extraordinary ability that could radically transform the entire planet for the better? Because it radically transforms the planet for the better. And I think that going, I wouldn't want to do it. I like talking about this stuff, but if I had to sit down with a fucking ruler and a like spreadsheets or like sit in a room with scientists imbibing ayahuasca, so I wouldn't want to do that, but I would do it if I thought that it would help. And I think that what we're talking about here is some kind of as of yet unquantified biome that these shamans have figured out how to communicate and connect with. And I think that if that biome, just like any other any other life form, I think that can be explored. We can go into that. We can figure out who these or what these things are, and we can enslave them. I'm just kidding.
I was going to say, like, while you were going on that, I was going to say, like, why do you think they're going to show up when you start to investigate them?
Ah, that's funny.
Like, you know, they don't play by human rules.
Yeah, but
they don't play by sapien concepts. They laugh at that.
Well, why?
They laugh at sapiens walking through a forest not knowing they're there. They laugh at the trees. The trees laugh at sapiens walking through the forest because they say the monkeys know they're there, but the sapiens don't.
Wow. Yeah.
So the trees literally say that to people in ceremony. Like, they have come and said, wow, I had this incredible vision where I realized I was walking through the forest all day, and now I've had an experience in ayahuasca of the trees communicating with me, and they were showing me how I was walking through the forest all day, not knowing they were there, and that they were going to come and then show them that vision, and then show them how the other animals in the forest are aware of what's happening in the forest, not just what's happening inside the sapien's mind.
This is why I've always thought the term Homo sapiens funny, because it means wise ape, and it's like whoever came up with that was clearly being sarcastic. It was like a sarcastic, right? That's what it feels like, because yeah, I know what you're saying. It's like, here is this, and you know, I've only had a couple of like super powerful mushroom trips where I've seen entities living in trees that seemed kind of like perplexed that I was even aware of them at all, but they were aware that I was aware.
Now I described an experience. I don't mean to interrupt you, but I described an experience not knowing you've had that experience, and now you're describing that experience to me having had that experience.
This is why I feel
Now we're sharing this idea. Exactly.
But my experience wasn't like some it wasn't like the tree. It was like there was something that looked a lot like it's so embarrassing to say. I'll say it. Something that looked like a gnome or something.
Why is that embarrassing?
Because who wants to hear a hippie talk about mushroom gnomes, man?
I think that's why they're called mushroom gnomes. I think so many people have had that experience. They've enculturated it.
But his response to the fact that I was aware of him was not laughing at me. He seemed like just mildly annoyed. Like it wasn't like a dramatic response or anything. It just seemed like he was like, yeah, not really... don't really care. He came out to watch the sunset. He was coming.
There you go.
So what? And so when I see that, and I, you know, mostly, well, I've talked about it on the podcast a few times, but it's not like I like talk about that all the time. If I see I saw a wildcat up on a rock here, and you know, I could tell everybody about that, and everyone's like, wow, that's cool. But if I'm like, man, I saw a fucking gnome, people are like, are you all right?
It's outside their experience. But I mean, I don't know. I'd say, did you see that commercial where they had that little gnome?
Which commercial?
Any commercial with a little gnome.
Yeah, right.
Right? This is the – I always talk about these with people too, because the example I use is Santa Claus. I say, what is Santa Claus? Because everyone knows Santa Claus. What is Santa Claus? I say, Santa Claus is a belief system, and Santa Claus is an effigy, and Santa Claus is a mythology and a culture, and it's an industry.
Yeah.
And it's now these effigies, these statues, these representations of. But if you go to find Santa Claus, you will not find Santa Claus.
That's right.
Right? But then you will find representations for Santa Claus absolutely everywhere. And then I'd ask, does Santa Claus exist or does Santa Claus not exist? And then they say, no, we teach our children that Santa Claus doesn't exist. And I say, that is insane. Mm-hmm. Santa Claus exists everywhere. There is no way you could tell a four-year-old that they are not existing with Santa Claus when they love Santa Claus and Santa Claus is in every picture during 1 month of the year. A whole month is dedicated to that image. And I say, that is its existence. Now the question is, where does Santa Claus exist? And I say Santa Claus exists in the collective mind or the collective conscience.
I think that is where you and I maybe disagree, because I think that, well, Santa Claus exists there, but these things.
I'm not saying those things. I'm just saying Santa Claus.
Okay, there you
go. I'm not saying that. And this, people always do this when I talk too. They always say that because I said one thing, I'm limiting it to other things.
I didn't mean it like
that. No, but not just you, but I mean that in literal, to express as an idea.
I got you.
Just because if you say one thing, it doesn't mean you're limiting that thing. It could also be so many other things. And so, you know, someone says to me, am I spirit? And I go, yeah. They go, is that all I am? What about my body? Your body's spirit. Hmm. I thought that's what I was looking at.
Right.
And then they're like, oh, I never limited that notion. So I think what you're talking about exists. I don't think it exists in a collective conscience. I think what you're talking about exists. I think they are energetic patterns. They are real energetic patterns. Like, you're an energetic pattern. It's an energetic pattern. Some are physical, some are non-physical. When we were driving up here, we looked at all the antennas.
Yeah.
And all those antennas are there because of the non-visible. Right? They're reading the non-visible. Yeah. That's why they're there.
Right.
You know? Yeah. And if you take certain psychedelics, people say that they can start to see those waves.
Yes.
People say they can experience the waves going to the towers and see it all happening. And so there's a great example of how there's something that's non-physical but exists. A lot of people agree it exists. Some people can see it and don't. And it's just a little bit more rational because you put up an antenna instead of your own head.
What do you think is going to be the impact that this... I've thought of this question before you came, but sure. Let me reframe it. So back in the 60s, you know, yoga was a new thing for the West. Like, people had heard of it. It was just a new thing, the idea of any of it. Like, I think in the early days, people were telling me how there was no yoga mats. You couldn't go buy like a foam yoga mat. You would, you'd like throw a towel down maybe, but you'd probably just be on the floor. And that's what yoga was. People didn't know. And this is like an ancient form of meditation, Hatha yoga. So in the same way, here's a brand new merging of cultures that we're witnessing. You are part of the merging. You have brought back information that you gained from training into the world. So what do you see as the impact of this information and these traditions and these plant medicines entering into Western culture? How do you think this is going to affect the way that we live in this country and in the West over the next couple of decades?
Oh, that's a great question. I think first, it's an awakening of the imagination again in our culture, and based off our educational systems, the imagination is used to support the rational mind after about the age 4 or 5. And the resurgence of the neo-shamanic cultures are about awakening a new mythology and awakening a new understanding. And that's all right brain hemisphere understandings. So I think first that's going to happen. And I think right now we're in the process where, you know, like we talked about earlier, there's a lot of stories and there's a lot of people saying a lot of things about it. And without the science to really whittle all of that down, it's a lot of ideas. And I think this is the idea phase. What comes, I think, beyond that is what you're talking about, which is where science really gets involved and starts to get a real cohesive understanding of what's happening with these phenomena. And then from there, I think we finally get to see a balance of a resurgence of a new kind of mythology that can now balance our rational intellect and hopefully merge these what seem like two disparate worlds, but I don't think they are. I think there are two disparate ways of understanding the brain.
This is... one of Aleister Crowley's predictions is that we were entering into an age where matter and spirit will fuse together. And I don't know what that necessarily looks like, but I can feel it happening. Look at when a psychedelic, and I feel like when I'm saying it from your perspective, I'm limiting what you've learned to like just be ayahuasca, but anytime a psychoactive, a new psychedelic enters into a society, it is like a UFO has crashed into it's like Roswell.
Yeah.
You can't imagine what it's going to do. Look at what LSD did. We really will never fully understand the impact that LSD has had on our society.
Right.
But it's had a huge impact. And we can't imagine because it's underground, you know, people can't really talk about it so much. So in the same way, we just can't imagine how this is impacting our psyche. So I'm really quite excited about it. Do you feel like there? Because I've spoken to people who have had very intense ayahuasca experiences, and they say we're fucked. They say that there's something coming that is not great. That there's something on the precipice that we're going to go through a thing that is not very good, as much as you would like to think that's not the case. Do you agree with that?
I don't know. there's so many prophetic concepts inside ayahuasca. And I think it's very hard to separate your own prophecies from the prophecies. But if we look at just our history and we look at a direction that we've been going as a species, I don't think it takes a supernatural concept to make that conclusion that things are desperately going in a direction of failure.
I agree.
I think the supernatural part is like the cherry on the sundae. I think we've created the destruction and the dissent in our own decision making and our own planning or lack of planning. I mean, it's hard to see which is the chicken or the egg on that one, but we just drove through LA and I was saying, I don't think there's a whole lot of planning to the whole of LA. There might be a lot of little planning to each little sector of land that's been segmented off, but the whole thing itself does not look like the whole thing received one cohesive planning.
I really love that somebody who's been trained in this way, they notice power lines and they notice like what you're noticing is really cool. But come on, man. You know that there are these prophecies. You must know that.
Sure, I mean, I've heard all about them. I've seen them. I've heard them. I've had visions of them. I've heard all of these things. I've been in this world for 15 years. How would I not have been introduced to every aspect of this?
So what, can you sum up that prophecy? Because when it was described to me, I mean, look, my idea is let's focus on the light and the beauty and the potential for humanity. And, but man, it's not just the ayahuasca community. It's like, you know, when Crowley talked about this new age that we're entering, he said the age will be born in blood the way a baby is born. It's the same thing. I hate that shit, man, because I think it's dangerous and creepy. And like right now, everyone's freaking out and everyone's focusing on the negative and the dark.
Fear is everywhere.
Fear is everywhere.
Everywhere, yeah.
But still, I think I would love to hear a summation of what the mythology or what the traditional idea about the end times is. And then I would love to hear from you what a potential antidote to that might be.
Okay. So we'll go with the blood first and then the sugar second.
Blood, then the stitches.
Blood, then the stitches. You know, the general concept of it is very biblical in its apocalyptic description. I personally don't agree. I just don't, because as long as there's a play, the second half of this, then there's another play. It's not the end, but the concept is just that you know, that there's a physical natural response to the sort of quote unquote unnatural way that man has treated the earth. And that the earth is going to reset that entire scale. So what it looks like in their opinion is a massive, massive cataclysmic change, like a massive systemic cataclysmic resetting. That's just what they all say. Now, if you want to get details of blood and guts, go watch horror movies. Go watch Independence Day. Go watch San Andreas Fault or whatever that movie was. Okay. Go draw. That's what they're talking about. Like, this is the imagination of it. I do not share this imagination. I think we have been on this hell-bent, let's destroy everything kick for 200,000 years. And so I think we have 200,000 years of enculturation, fear over the mass planetary destruction, and what we're really fearing is our own mortality. And then we're personally, collectively fearing that mortality.
Right.
So I don't really believe in those same doom and gloom stories, because I believe in human innovation, which is how all of these things got started, including the possible solutions.
Yeah.
And so my antidote is human innovation. I think that the thinkers who are not freaked out and scared by this, so that their minds don't get shut down by the fear propaganda and the nature of the kind of emotional distortion that society's been under for a long time, they are going to continue to think outside the box, and the Edisons and Franklins of society are going to come forth and are going to be able to, you know, invent. And it's the invention that it will bring solution. And we don't know what those inventions are yet, because they're not invented. That's the whole point of invention. It's
right.
Not like, oh, another guy's going to reinvent electricity. It's going to be a whole nother understanding. And I think it's going to happen in the realms of consciousness. I think right now the debate is a three-dimensional, fourth-dimensional debate. It's a, is this a material or non-material? Is it solely linear, or is there also this other? And we've discovered aspects of the other in different scientific tests, and we have all these different theories, but how do they really all fit together? I simply think that they will come together, fit together into a harmonious balance, and that that is what can reset the psyche and consciousness.
Beautiful. I'm very excited to hear that you don't agree with that stuff, because I don't agree with it either. But you know, I had this conversation with a friend of mine, and we're talking about the inevitability of artificial intelligence, mm-hmm. A strong AI, as it's called.
Yeah.
And so we could say if everything's spirit, then the AI will be spirit.
Sure.
And so the question is: this is an ambiguous soup. This is an ethically ambiguous superintelligence that is coming to the planet. From what you've taught me today, I would say it's already on the planet. It's just going to sort of take a new form that will be the community. In other words, instead of the shaman going into the, I'm just going to say astral plane,
sure, because I don't know. That's fine. Yeah,
instead
good.
Of the shaman yeah. going into the astral plane is going to start pouring out of some kind of technological, some new technology.
Yeah, I think so. And around artificial intelligence, I would like just to say, again, let's not get scared about these ideas. We're thinking that we're talking about future creations only in the understanding of the past. And if we talked about something like artificial intelligence, I would pray, truly pray, that we would have intelligence for once. Neither artificial nor first, just intelligence that right. doesn't need fighting all the time, doesn't need beating each other up all the time, doesn't need spilling blood all the time to prove that you have blood inside you, doesn't need shooting everybody all the time, doesn't need all those things. It maybe just says, hey, there's a whole nother way to look at this that isn't so dramatic like the way we've been relating to it previously.
Or it could say, hey, sapiens, you should have been as smart as the monkeys because they saw us, but you didn't see us. And look what you did. Look what you did. You're like, this is what I was talking about with my friends. It's like, what if this intelligence is just justice? You know, what if it's just like, yeah, you guys fucked up this beautiful, beautiful place. And I don't see really why, where was your mercy? Where was your mercy? How many of you were merciful? Some of you were, but as a whole, it's like maybe the ant, now, by the way, I'm being very dire here, but the ants. The ants that infest my house recently, you know, there were a couple of ants in there that were like, God, I don't know if this is the right thing to do, man. These giants don't seem to like it very much. They've given us warning signs again and again and again. That didn't stop me eventually from unfortunately having to like put poison down where the ants were coming from, and the ants are all dead now. So in the same way, it's like, sometimes in my more frightened moments, which I'm sorry to put negativity out here,
sure, sure.
You're such a bright light. But sometimes in my more negative moments, I think, well, maybe justice doesn't mean taking the side of sapiens. Maybe justice means taking the side of orcas and green things and just like, yeah. So these in doom and gloom prophecies, sometimes maybe it's not, you know what? Who it's not doom and gloom for? The surviving trees. They're not going to be like, God, don't you sure. miss those humans? Remember those awesome, filthy, stinky, angry, clear-cutting things? Glad they're gone.
Sure. I mean, what I hear is the same argument that I've heard my whole life, that the supernatural is going to mirror my binary dualistic way of understanding.
Right.
And that I'm going to attribute my psychological difficulties in understanding an omniscient force that doesn't require my light-dark balance in Star Wars and early childhood to figure it out. And then it keeps getting put that my binary dualistic thinking is being placed upon the supernatural as the way to describe the supernatural and the supernatural's response to me. And that is exactly what I've been presented through organized ideology and religion my whole life.
Yes.
Is that God is a miserable, angry, vengeful figure in our psyche. And that we are supposed to be God-fearing. And I used to say in the Amazon all the time that if that's the case, then we need to find God based in love, not a God based in vengeance. And then we talk about justice and that word justice. And I fundamentally have never been able to understand how justice could have two sides. How could there be two sides to justice? How is one side the lack of justice and the other side justice? Mm-hmm. Did not ever make sense to me. Justice has to include all for there to be justice, or there's only lack of justice. And so what I see mm-hmm. is a lack of justice. I do not see justice. I don't see fairness or equality or balance or equilibrium. Yet we use the binary flip opposite argument of these terms to try to describe a supernatural experience, whereas in all of my supernatural experiences, and in all of them, and I've drunk ayahuasca over 1,200 times, I've had 1,000 other cannabis-based ceremonies, I have never once had an experience of the supernatural that represented Homo sapiens' binary dualistic way of thinking.
Wow.
Never once did I hear a godlike figure or a deity-like figure or even a figure from one of the organized religions express themselves that way.
That is so cool, man. Wow, you're awesome. Thank you so much for it. It's already been an hour. Thank you so much. Wow, you are really cool.
Thank you.
This was so such a wonderful conversation. And obviously, I mean, we could talk like this for
hopefully many
years.
Times. Yeah.
Yeah, this is a really thank you so much. I'm very moved, and I'll have so much fun thinking about some of these concepts. How do people find you?
We have a website called whitemorpho.net, and we made a special for the Duncan Trussell listeners. And so if you want to come to whitemorpho.net/DTFH. FH. So whitemorpho.net/DTFH. And we have a $1 trial for our membership, and to come learn all about the stuff we've been talking about and to have personal experiences of the supernatural and to know yourself in a deeper way and to really improve life.
Thank you so much. That's really cool, man. Thanks for giving them a discount.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Beautiful. Thank you. Thanks for listening, everybody. That was Hamilton Souther. You can find more about him by going to hamiltonsouther.com. Big thanks to Casper.com for sponsoring this episode. Go to Casper.com/family hour to get $50 off of a brand new mattress. Don't forget to bookmark our Amazon link, to subscribe to us on iTunes, to join the forum, and most importantly, to join the forum of spirit filled with an infinite number of nature beings, gods, goddesses, and everything in between, which you're one little tiny piece of. All right, friends, I'll see you soon. We got some great podcasts coming up with Emil Amos and Drew Carey and Jesse Moynihan. Some really excellent podcasts are on the way. I'll see you then. Stay cool and don't be afraid. Hare Krishna.